Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are joined by Dr. Bjarke Liboriasen. Bjarke joined the School of International Communications as an assistant professor in 2012 and was promoted to associate professor in digital and creative media in 2019.
Bjarke's research follows two main strands, the use of tools and technologies in creative labor and video games. He's currently working on a monograph about cinematic video game adaptation, and it's going to be published by Edinburgh University Press.
That's a really good university
press. That is an awesome press.
I know, and I'm not biased because I have a book with them too.
Absolutely not.
It
is obviously the best if Mary also has a book there.
Thank you, Derek. Okay. In 2023, Bjarke published the paper, Video Game Adaptations as Opportunities for Remembering Gameplay, in the journal Game Studies. Now, Derek, the journal Game Studies sounds like my kind of journal, to be honest.
This one sounds pretty exciting. If I'm not mistaken, you have a PS4 at home, right?
Oh, it's gathering dust. I tried.
Man.
I really tried. I wanted to get into it when I actually got my promotion to associate professor. That was my present to me. Mm-hmm. I said I'm going to get into video games like I used to when I'm when I was a teenager, and I used to play in the arcade and all of that.
Pong?
I'm not that old. Like, this is you speaking from your experience.
Some of us don't remember
the invention of the telephone and all the rest of it. But I feel like, yeah, I do have a PS4, and your son really tried to get me going with it. He really did. You know, a lot of effort from Jamie there. That was fantastic. But it just didn't take, and it's gathering dust. And it's actually something I feel very ashamed of, because I need to sell it and I need to let it go, but I can't bring myself to do it.
Oh, man. You know, I got a PS5.
Really?
Yeah, because I had to one-up you.
Oh.
And so that's
that
why
purely
I'm...
purely the reason you got a PS5?
Solely
to
brag about it at this very moment. But I have some real affinity for what Bjarke is talking about in this paper, because I am super into, in my case, role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably what I'm going to associate this with, although obviously this goes well beyond those type of games.
Sure.
So I think what we need to do first, though, is we have to ask our guest to give us a brief introduction to the paper.
Derek, sounds like you're telling me just basically to be quiet and shut up.
I am inviting you to be quiet.
Okay. Actually, I completely agree with you. Okay. We must really ask Bjarke, who is here with us today in the lab. Please, Bjarke, give us an overview of your excellent paper that we both really enjoyed reading.
Thank you so much. I was enjoying listening to your banter.
We're perfecting it. It's a work in progress.
It's a hard slog.
Yeah.
And thanks for plugging the book to come, which would be the first monograph on the topic, cinematic video game adaptation. The article from last year, Video Game Adaptations as Opportunities for Remembering Gameplay, can be seen as a sort of warm-up exercise, something that leads into that book project. And not much has actually been written about this specific topic. We are talking about transmedia storytelling. We are talking about how media are connected with each other in various fascinating ways. But adaptations of video games into film is a really under-researched topic. So that in itself was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, write this article. And I noticed in both scholarly and also sort of newspaper reviews of video game adaptations, that there was a tendency, both from scholars and reviewers, to reduce video games to standard tropes such as characters and stories. Characters and stories are super important, of course, but you overlook what is unique to games, their gameplay. And that's what I'm trying to do here in the text, that I'm trying to put into words some of these experiences from games that are adapted into these video game films. So that's roughly why I did this and what I'm trying to do here.
I thought it was really interesting as well, Bjarke, how you brought in the notion of genre in order to do that. So the idea that a first-person shooter, for example, has a means of gameplay which becomes a kind of learned physical response. So you have to train yourself in a way on how to play a certain type of game. And then the remembering is both a cognitive and an embodied act.
Absolutely. The idea of grounded cognition informs the paper. In game studies, and I consider myself a member of this interdisciplinary field of studies, game studies, we are, of course, very focused on highlighting what is unique to games and their embodied nature, that we play them with our bodies. But there's a risk of reducing embodied cognition to just that, that we overlook that our cognition also takes place outside of, not only outside the body, but also outside of the brain, that it takes place in places, in social contexts. And that's what grounded cognition is all about. Just to open some of the theoretical discussion that takes place in the paper. Because there have, in my field, in game studies, there have been attempts at drawing on insights from phenomenology, from cognition. And right now, I think grounded cognition is probably one of the more interesting strands in this thought. Our thinking is not just taking place in the brain. It's not just taking place in the body. We also need to take places and social contexts into account. And genre that you picked up on there, that's one of the attempts to doing just that.
That absolutely fascinates me. And I'm pleased that we began this discussion by talking about grounded cognition, because that was one of the most, I think, interesting parts of the paper for me. However, you also began by saying that actually there is so little written in this field, and that actually your book is the first that is coming out on this subject. That amazes me, because in your appendix, in your article, you listed all of the many, many films there are that are adaptations of video games. But you say that there isn't anybody looking at this from this perspective, this grounded cognition perspective, in essence. Why is that? Why is there such a gap? I mean, why are you the first here when there are so many of these movies actually being made?
Well, many? Well, it's 47, the way I'm counting it. I'm counting all video games that are made in English with a budget of at least $10 million adjusted for inflation. And that brought me to 47. I have watched them all with screenshots and notes, etc. It is still manageable. It's still possible for one analyst to watch 47 films. Of course, there are more now. Maybe we are up at 60 or 65 or something like that. But it's not that... The number is not that high yet. It's still manageable. One of the reasons I think why not that much have been written about video game adaptation is that a lot of them, most of them, are really poor. No matter how you approach it, many of them are just really bad films.
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, it is.
I'm sorry. For sure. I'm sorry. And I feel
that
like...
That makes me really disappointed. I really liked Resident Evil. I love the Resident Evil series.
Let's not say anything bad about the Resident Evil series or the series, the underlying series of survival horror video games. They are fantastic. But there are a lot of sort of very crass attempts at making money from something that... filmmakers are thinking, oh, this franchise has already been established in the consumer's mind, so let's try and make some more money out of that. And some of these attempts are lazy and really bad. Sometimes it becomes hilariously bad and camp, and that's beautiful and fun to watch, of course.
I am just thinking, while you're saying they're lazy and bad, a movie being lazy and bad has never stopped an academic analyzing it before.
Right. That is probably true. And there, of course, if you talk about B film or exploitative cinema and bad cinema, there are parts of film studies that go that route. But I think there's still a certain snobbishness when it comes to video game adaptations into film.
Mm-hmm. Is that a snobbishness that is often, I mean, is this true in my sort of experience, this snobbishness tends to be directed towards the people who watch those movies rather than the movies themselves. So there was always a sort of distaste about looking at, say, popular forms of culture in the past, or looking at products that are for women or for young people, things like this. Often this snobbishness was less about the product and the quality of the product, and more about the social status of the consumer, shall we say, and the attitude towards that.
That has probably changed. I think a lot of the filmmakers who are making films today, they might be gamers, they might know what the medium can do. There's a fascinating trend. Sam Mendes did a fantastic film that pretends to be in one take. Was it the first World War film? Was it called
1917.
I was grappling with the number. I was afraid of saying the wrong number. So thank you, 1917. And there was a great article out a couple of years ago where the author is, Mike Sell, is saying that that's a video game film, that you can make an argument for saying that 1917 is a video game film, that filmmaker Sam Mendes was inspired by how video games work. He was inspired, by the way, not from being a gamer himself, but because he was watching his kids play. I won't go into the details of that argument, but it's quite inspiring, and it's quite thought-provoking to think of 1917 as a video game film. So I think filmmakers and the public at large is probably over that gruff snobbishness that was definitely there but it's only a few years ago. Things have changed pretty fast.
There's a lot of interplay between film made from a video game, video games made from films, and then you get into graphic novels and things like that. So when I was reading through this, one of the fascinating parts for me is thinking about the notions of adaptation. And so there's literary theories of adaptation, like those of Linda Hutchin and Julie Sanders, who've written extensively on varying kinds of adaptation. And then there's, as you're just saying now, this reminds me of kind of motifs or something that go through. So you have something like Scott Pilgrim versus the World. You have the later Jumanji films. So there's the two Jumanji films that are basically video game-esque and have all of these elements there. And then the Ryan Reynolds film Free Guy, right, which is basically emulating a video game. So how do you fit those into this kind of model? Because I know you didn't use them because they're not based on video games per se, but where do you think that type of homage might fit in?
I think this framework that I'm offering here could easily be used to analyze these films, that you could find examples of how gameplay is remembered also in a film that is not an adaptation of a specific game or game genre itself, for sure. And Hutchins' theory of adaptation also deals with memory. She talks about a palimpsestuous memory, about how when you watch the film, for example, that under that there is a shadow of the novel in some sense. And I did, in a first draft of this article, I did discuss how we can think about the idea of memory in adaptation studies, how you can think about social memory and also memory as a real thing that is happening in a brain. But I simply cut that out to make this article focused. And that also, by the way, might explain why I'm not going into the fringe films you're mentioning here. I'm trying to go to a relatively tight corpus of films, and then in there trying to make some clear observations and show how these concepts can be useful for making observations, for making analytical observations, And then maybe we can go from there and go out again to also to the films that are, what did you say? They are video game esque or something
Yeah. They're homages to it.
Yes.
So these,
yes.
You know, there are elements that are absolutely meant to be video gaming.
Yeah.
And they take advantage of some of the tropes that you would find in video games, like number of lives you might have, or getting power ups, or things like that.
Yeah. A useful concept for thinking about that is intermedial reference. Mm. When a medium is thematizing or evoking a trope, as you describe it, having three lives or being able to restart a game, having a save point, or in the article, I'm talking about having an avatar. How that is, of course, an experience that is unique to the medium of the video game, but the film can use its own unique affordances to evoke or thematize that experience. And that's actually, to me, that's the most interesting part of this article. I really like this idea that we are sometimes experiencing video game adaptations that puts us in between the video game and the film. That it's almost as if you're watching. It's almost as if you are playing a video game. Of course, you're not confused. As a film viewer, I understand that I'm watching a film. I'm not sort of mentally confused in that sense. But there is this sense of being in between video game and film. And that kind of intermedial viewing, those kind of experiences, I'm trying to put those experiences into words with this thinking about adaptations as opportunities for remembering gameplay. That's actually what I'm really trying to get at, that in-betweenness in experience.
I like the concept. Sorry, I'm talking too much because I'm too excited at the moment. But the notion...
You can tell, you're like jumping in your seat as you ask. Continue.
So this idea of gameplay versus narration, perhaps, and you've got... The gameplay element where you have control over what's happening, and then the narrative or the narration where there's something happening that you're unable to control. So you use Assassin's Creed, the leap, right?
Yeah, the leap of faith. Yeah.
But I've been playing The Witcher a lot lately, which I'm sure that my lovely wife will attest to and tell you I was completely lost to.
I'll ask her about it.
You really shouldn't. They use a huge amount of narrative interlude in that game. So there's, to me, there's kind of a Klein going on here where you can have more filmic elements in a game versus the amount of gameplay or the other way around. So if you're in a first person shooter, there's very little of that takes place, presumably.
Yes.
Yeah. So I wonder how useful those two notions then become.
Yeah, I guess we are getting back to the sort of old schism between, we're talking about media products that sometimes feel like games and sometimes feels like film. And it used to be that when you are trying to combine these two media types, the results are not hitty. They're sort of bastard responses in a bad way. But today's game designers have really sort of upped their game. I mean, it's so smooth the way you move in and out of sequences that are film-like, and then you're back into the game again. It's become so smooth that movement from film into game. So that if a student, for example, Googles ludology, then narratology comes up. I mean, this idea that games should be thought of as games and they should not be confused with storytelling. That idea, that conflict between storytelling and gaming is over. I mean, there's no point in being stuck in that debate that was not really a debate, but it's something that happened a few years ago. But if you use the internet, as we all do, to find more information, you will probably, and the students will probably find that conflict between game as game and game as story, so the narratological perspective. And there's no point in choosing between the two, because as you have experienced with The Witcher, the ludonarrative advances in game design are so impressive now. So there's no point really in getting stuck on that.
You make a very compelling argument, I think, Bjarke. I really like, as somebody who studies horror films and enjoys violent movies, for example, I really like your emphasis on grounded cognition and this idea of memory being in the body and the pleasure coming from this sort of bodily, physical memory. You talk about how the viewer may remember gameplay as a lingering sense of an extended body schema. However, that also reminds me of one of the sort of major critiques of film studies, which is that you're supposing how the viewer actually responds to the text. So it isn't so much, it's based on textual analysis, and we are putting a certain sensation or experience upon the viewer. And there are problems with doing that. We're taking sort of agency, we're potentially seeing what we want to see. But that's how this conversation begins to an extent. So my kind of opening sort of question to this was, has there been any wider research? Has there been any research into the way that viewers respond? Did you do any wider sort of looking at things like the way that people have responded to these films in any way, or are there planned projects around this?
No and no. I'm not calling your answer a standard question to diminish it. I'm just saying that a question like that often comes up when close readings are being questioned. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing here is a type of close reading. And of course, there have been criticism of close reading since it began. But I still think that there are value in trying to map some of these, let's just call it standard or expected responses to the media products that we are looking at. I do talk about standard players in connection with genre, that there are some ways of responding to first-person shooters, some ways of responding to survival horror games that are expected and typical and normal. And we can probably, I imagine we could easily go out and have some of these expectations confirmed by talking to players or by using experiments to see how we could try and track where eyeballs are flying around on the screen when people get scared, or we could look at how heart rates go up when people are scared, etc., etc. Yes, we could go out and try and confirm some of these expectations, but I'm just putting my work somewhere else. Right. I'm trying to do these close readings. I'm trying to show how these concepts are useful for understanding these media phenomena.
That's sort of an interesting answer, because I came at it from quite a subjective position as somebody who enjoys these movies, but doesn't enjoy and isn't very interested in playing video games. And I actually thought that I would like video games because I like these movies, but it doesn't work like that, I guess. So I'm sort of interested in where it is that I get my pleasure from in consuming these movies.
Yeah, I just imagine that anybody who enjoys Resident Evil, and when we say Resident Evil, we are talking about the six Anderson films with Mila Jovovich in the lead role as Alice, the protagonist of those six films. I just imagine that anybody who watched those would also enjoy playing these Resident Evil survival horror games. And you are telling me that you tried and you didn't like them?
Okay, I'm overstating my case. I did like them when I was younger, but I didn't play enough of them or be immersed enough of them for that to have been a real motivation for me to enjoy this film, I would say. I enjoyed it as an action movie that had a female lead. I like the main character. It was violent. It was an interesting story. All of those things, I think, were the source of pleasure. And I remember actually going to see the film with my friend when we were very young, and her saying to me suddenly, why are all the adverts for video games at the start of the movie? And I turned to her and I said, because it's based on a video game.
Oh.
And she said, really? Is it? And I was like, yeah. And neither of us actually really had that knowledge at all. We went for quite different reasons. But maybe if it was the case nowadays, as young women who sort of are interested in media, we would now be game players, perhaps.
Maybe or maybe not, right?
Mm.
Because they're not exclusive. You can enjoy the video game and not the movie, maybe, or vice versa.
It would be interesting to find people like Mary, if I may say so.
Well, shoot them.
It would actually be super interesting to try do focus groups with film people who enjoy the films but don't play the games, or enjoy the games and hate the films. I mean, it would actually be interesting to see what kind of nuances we can tease out of this. And it's fascinating how some viewers of these products are unaware of the connection, the adaptation-ness of the film. And that's probably very deliberate. People who watch the TV series The Last of Us, they don't understand that this is actually an adaptation of a fantastic video game. Baldur's Gate 3, we were talking about PlayStation 5 just before, is not advertised as a Dungeons & Dragons video game, which is kind of strange.
Which is odd, because one of the top of them, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And the connections are highlighted all the time. Every time you make a roll, you see a 20-sided die roll around. So you are reminded constantly that we are actually looking at a video game adaptation of a tabletop role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons. There must have been some really big decision taken here that we are not trying to stamp D&D on Baldur's Gate because maybe we will scare some consumers away. I'm just not privy to these decisions that are made. I'm sure at very high level when it comes to marketing of these things.
Well, this goes straight into one of my major questions when I was looking at, you know, the kind of invitation to play, in this case, the Assassin's Creed. But it kind of inspired me to the question of, you know, which economic purpose is being served here? You know, which way is the money flowing? And so is the film being made to, I guess, take advantage of a success of a video game, or are the video game developers looking to create a film to increase the success of the game? What is do you know the economics behind these type of things? As you said, in this case, all of these films are 10 million plus budget, right?
Yeah. There is this myth that the video games industry is bigger than the film industry. I think it's a bit of a myth. And it's certainly a myth when it comes to the relationship between film production and game production, that the film productions are dominant, very dominant in the relationship. So when you have a film being made based on a game, it's the filmmakers who call all the shots.
Right. That's what I was wondering. So that's really interesting to me. They have a kind of remaining cultural cachet via the control of the economics. Is that?
Yeah, I don't dare speak to the reasons why it's like that, but it's kind of surprising when you casually find stories about how these productions play out. And it's something that's confirmed in some academic texts that I think I reference in this article, by the way. So, yeah.
I do actually remember reading something about that in the latest Dungeons & Dragons movie, where even though it was titled Dungeons & Dragons, there was a very significant attempt to actually move away from some of the connotations of the actual game. And when I also went to see that with a group of friends, and half of us who weren't Dungeons and Dragons players and half of whom were, it was interesting that actually it seemed like the people who got the most enjoyment out of it were the ones who actually weren't the players in many ways, because the movie was playing around so much and changing so much of the mythology around this game.
Yeah. I'm not sure if your friends are representative.
I'm sure that
So many ways.
We're talking about academics here.
There are
definitely
levels. Yeah.
No, in the sort of fandom discussions of the latest Dungeons and Dragons adaptation, a thing that has been highlighted and celebrated is the way that the film manages to emulate the experience of sitting around a table and playing a Dungeons and Dragons game, the goofiness of the situation.
Yeah, the attendant ridiculousness.
That there is something about that film that feels a bit like a successful D&D session. And that's something that several commentators have picked up on. And
well, that means we're way too serious when we play it, basically. We need to be more goofy.
Yeah, definitely need to be goofy.
I'm not goofy enough.
Oh, that's
I thought
all
I
you,
was.
Mary.
I thought I was. Oh, sorry, Bjork.
No, I guess the goofy attempt to enjoy Dungeons and Dragons is sort of connected with these real play podcasts and YouTube channels. It's that type of play is certainly sort of chimes with the attitude fantasy in that film. So maybe the more goth or dark play style that you and your friends have doesn't fit then.
But that's an interesting story. Dungeons and Dragons is an interesting one because, of course, the video games were adapted from the notions of the pen and paper game, right? Like the old school pencil and paper rolling. And then you got into things like Dungeons and Dragons Online, and it created the kind of radiant quest idea, and when you band together with different groups for that purpose anyway. And then that's led into some other types of RPGs, which I think now Baldur's Gate is the major one. I'm not sure where I was going with this, but I'm very excited because it's not necessarily a video game film the way even you were describing it, right? It's going old school in some ways to the pencil and paper sessions.
Yeah, I haven't actually thought about that because my logic here is that when you are adapting a video game, you are adapting the non-trivial traversal of the text. When you are reading a novel, for example, a paper version of a novel, then the traversal of the text will consist in the reader turning the pages of the book. That's non-trivial. To get from A to B in a gothic text, in a video game, for example, you need to do something non-trivial. You need to do something with your body. You need to use your mind, of course. You need to interpret that a lot of stuff is going on in the mind, but you also need to do something with your body and something that is non-trivial. It takes effort. So that in itself, that non-trivial effort to traverse the text, that can be adapted into the film. And that's my article is about, that is actually what you are adapting, because it wouldn't make any sense to try and adapt the critic of a novel into a film. That would be very strange and boring. But you can't do something with the traversal of a video game text.
I was picking up on one of your previous points where you were talking about the fandom and thinking about the television adaptation of The Witcher, where there were two seasons, I think, that were
three.
Wildly popular. No, the two.
And then they changed the
That's
main,
right. And, yeah. and then it really began to get away from the lore, I suppose. And this is what maybe a non-fan-based audience may or may not mind as much, but the people who are dedicated to the game start to get...
Basically, you mean the non-cool people like me?
No.
Because I'm coming out of this feeling distinctly non-cool. I thought
well, that's
I knew
a first,
my, yeah,
Mary. I'm cooler than you today.
Oh, Bjarke, look what you've done.
I don't know if you want to comment on that, like the role of adherence or movement away from the lore or the traversal.
Well, what I'm offering with the article is a way of talking about not only the enjoyment of getting games right when you're at that, but also try to put into words, why are gamers, why are fans so frustrated with when their favorite games are sort of mangled in some way when they are turned into to film. So a framework like this can also be used to describe frustrations, of course. And there are a lot of frustrations from fans of games. I don't know about The Witcher, to be honest. I'm not sure if it's just a question of changing the protagonist, changing the actor there.
Or the focus, I think, was some of the issue.
Right, right.
I'm not all up on it either. I'm just curious about...
I mean, frustration tends to be based around narrative and what you have characters do and not do. I mean, rather than kind of cognition, I would say. Mm. Whereas here we're talking much more about kind of pleasure in actually experiencing physical and bodily sensations, I say, specifically remembering the actual notion of playing the game.
Yeah. And I think pleasure is a really important word to use there. Because in game studies, and this is something my field has been criticized for quite recently, there's perhaps a tendency to think of playing a game as a very sort of cool and brain-focused thing you're doing, that you're sort of forgetting bodies and that bodies have desires and frustrations and sexuality. And I just wanted to...
But don't you get all those things from just watching a film that isn't a video game adaptation? Because a lot of the things, the sort of bodily sensations and all of this, it very much feels like something you would get from watching sort of a horror movie, for example. So this really gets specifically about pleasure of remembering actual playing of the game.
Yeah, and I think to sketch it in a clear way, I mean, the contrast between first-person shooters and survival horror, these two important genres in video games. In the article, I am, of course, simplifying things a bit, that we're thinking about the typical player of a first-person shooter as someone who is cool, calm, and collected, right? That in contrast to...
Really?
The,
is that the construction of a first-person shooter?
Oh, you have to. You have to be a successful player. You have to be a player of accuracy and control. Right.
Okay. Because to me, that's chaotic kids putting pennies in the arcade,
God, no.
Which was my experience.
Already in 2000, already in 1993, I believe, the US Army took Counter-Strike and used a modified version of that to explore whether it was possible to harness some of the abilities, some of the skills, mm-hmm. I mean, that were necessary for a successful shooter. Literally. So you can try and
train people,
thinking about a modified version of Counter-Strike as a training simulator. Mm-hmm. So that is, of course, a good soldier is not, how did you describe it, kids that are sort of flailing around?
Rage,
chaos. Me, I guess.
Oh,
right.
But that actually, the visceral thrill, and visceral I'm using deliberately because that's an embodied sensation, right, of being actively engaged in a virtual situation, I find much stronger in a video game, first of all. And then I can see the tie that you're making there. So when you have an adaptation of a video game, when something triggers that on the screen, you would then have, again, a much more embodied reaction potentially to what you're seeing based on having had that in your remembered past.
Sure, that you can make, the film can make a intermediate reference to first-person shooter gameplay. That, and there is a Doom, the film Doom, is using 5 minutes to make that intermediate reference to the video game Doom, of course.
Bjarke, your courses must be so popular. I mean, I'm really enjoying listening to this right now. And what you're actually studying must be so relevant to our students' lives here. So I would be queuing up to take your modules.
Well, we do have students taking a module I designed together with my good colleague, Paul Martin.
Do you call it game studies?
We call it digital games as communication, to as a little homage to the School of International Communication. So we it sort of fits into what the school is offering. It is basically an introduction to game studies. Mm. We go through what you can use games for in terms of communication. You can use them as educational tools. You can use games as a way of connecting people with each other. Of course, you can also think about communication when a game designer wants to say something to the player. You can think about games as art. And we're also trying to look at the more problematic aspects of gaming, representation of sexuality, violence, problematic representations of women, both in the games themselves and also in the wider discourses around games.
Mm-hmm. Do you go back into the history of games? I'm sort of wondering kind of what kind of knowledge of games do students come to your course with?
Well, you should ask, because we do attract gamers. We do attract students who are hardcore gamers. They tend to do quite poorly, because if you are really invested in something and you feel that, oh, I don't need to read anything, I understand everything, then you might be a little... You sort of disadvantage yourself. And students who come to a module about games, students who appreciate that to have a full overview of the contemporary digital media landscape, then you need to understand games, even if they are not gamers. So they come to it and aware of their limitations, and they study hard and they do well.
Mm-hmm.
So
is there a difference between students who are gamers and students who are interested in games in that way? Because I'm thinking of when I have film courses here, and I have students taking my film courses, and usually when they have enthusiasm for films, they like watching films, that means they like studying them. And they watch more and more of them, they gain historical knowledge and developmental knowledge and analytical knowledge and theoretical knowledge, and that all seems to work together with their passion. But it feels like this is not the case when studying video games.
I see your point. That might be a joint research project in itself, to look at the differences in gamers and film. How do we describe them? Film freaks, film enthusiasts, film fans.
I'm going to get you that T-shirt for sure.
No, but it is interesting how if students are really involved in either games or films, that they come to classes, they study in different ways. To be honest, I've admitted to students who take games module, they might disadvantage them. Mm-hmm. That's oddly what I've seen happening. And you experienced the opposite with students who are really into film.
Mostly, not all the time.
Right,
mostly.
Right. Maybe we should cut this from the recording, all of this, because I'm not sure. I'm not sure I want students who do poorly on my modules that listening to this and, oh God, yeah.
Your article has been out for a little while now. It was published in 2023, I think. Has there been any response to the article? Was there any criticism of it, any kind of engagement, or has it started any wider conversation that you're aware of?
Well, I noticed that the Center for Excellence in Game Studies in Finland picked up on it and wrote about it. And I got a very kind email from an American colleague who really appreciated that I managed to put into words some intuitions he had with these film adaptations of video games. And I really liked that, to be contacted by a peer exactly for putting into words an intuition that he was sort of grappling with. He couldn't put into words. I'm not sure if that leads to some sort of co-scholarship of some sort, but yeah, that was nice.
Is that what you're hoping for from the paper then, is to be able to make these contacts and maybe do some collaborative work, or are there other goals that you see coming from the paper?
Well, I've been more selfish or self-focused in writing this. this article is out, I have an article about looking at a gay Chinese dating app, Blood, as an example of casual gameplay, which I've written with a colleague. It's in review at the moment. And then I have a draft of an article that's about a video game where climate change leadership is evoked. So three articles, one about adaptation, one about a gay dating app, and one about climate change.
And your book on top of that.
Yeah, but all these three articles, they're all pointing towards that book project. So the book is tentatively titled Cinematic Video Game Adaptations, an eco-queer perspective. So it's about looking at themes of ecology and queerness and what happens to these intertwined themes when a video game becomes a film. That's the point of the book project. But the three articles I mentioned, they point towards that, that are leading towards that.
Is there a community of you in China, or are most of the people who study this, are they in different parts of the world? Because you're mentioning a lot of European and American scholars. Is this very sort of your American-centric as a field, or is there a group of you in China?
Game studies, like you said, yeah, it starts in North America and in Europe, particularly in Northern Europe. I'm Danish, and I had no trouble getting a PhD scholarship on a project about virtual worlds. But it would have been a different situation if I'd been in Southern Europe or, for example, in Asia, in China. So yes, game studies, of course, starts with these global centers of knowledge production. There have been more attention to video games from a scholarly perspective. 10 years ago, I was part of a group of colleagues here at UNNC, but also I also did this together with colleagues in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and mainland China. We started a scholarly network, a Chinese Digital Games Research Association, to boost scholarly attention to video games. So that was 2014.
Is it still going?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We launched it with a conference that I co-organized with Paul Martin, my good colleague. And since then, the network has had annual conferences. So it is absolutely still going strong. And I think that's very important. And I'm very happy to hear from young Chinese colleagues that it helps them. It helps them to explain to a grumpy dean or some hiring or sort of funding entity that there is something called game studies also here in China. So, yeah, that's good.
It's not just playing the games.
Oh, God, no.
As fun as that is,
it's
not just
really,
watching movies.
I really feel that I need to dust off my PlayStation
and get a PS5. You're still on a PS4. That's a little...
Yeah, but, you know, I barely got into the PS4. I'm not going to buy a PS5 before I've worked out the PS4. I just need to try more.
I'm not sure that's how it works.
Really?
Yeah, it's a little like having an old car, and I'm just going to drive my old car first, and then I don't know.
Oh, you'd be surprised, Bjarke. So when my son went back to Canada to go to school, he took his PS4 with him and left me his PS3 with stacks of
you're games. So uncool. You're
No, wait.
Yes,
there's a sort of retro angle coming up.
I reclaimed my corner. Right.
I did a year on that, and I got so hooked on Skyrim. I said, I need to get the anniversary edition. So that was my birthday present to myself, was a PS5, just so I could play Skyrim. And now I branched out into all these other things.
Yes. When I had a PlayStation 3, I bought a PlayStation 3 Slim.
Oh.
And nicknamed it the My Little Sony. That's pretty good. Eh?
That's not bad. I am not a brony per se, but I appreciate the homage.
Attempt at humor.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Bjarke. Thank you for sharing all of your research with us, and thank you for this excellent conversation. And your paper was absolutely fascinating, and we wish you all the best for the future.
I look forward to reading
more. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.